From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the rise and fall of BCCI. Los Angeles Times reporter Douglas Franz has just co-authored a new book about the world's most crooked bank. We'll also hear about Franz's recent investigation into how George Bush secretly aided Saddam Hussein before the war. Also today, Dreaming in Cuban. We'll talk with Christina Garcia about her first novel. It's the story of a family like her own, which was divided by the Cuban Revolution. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews clarinetist Don Byron's debut album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House is getting ready to vote on a Democratic-backed budget plan. Last night, it rejected a tax and spending blueprint from President Bush. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Last night, the House of Representatives defeated the president's budget with a bipartisan 370-42 vote. No Democrat voted for it, and 119 Republicans voted against it. They were worried about the political consequences of voting for the president's tax increases and spending cuts. The Democrats' budget would double the peace dividend President Bush wanted, sending most of the money paired from the military budget to domestic programs. In order to spend money from the military on domestic programs, Congress and the president would have to agree to change the 1990 budget agreement. If that proves to be impossible, the Democrats offered another option: cut the military by the same amount, but spend the savings on deficit reduction. Both the president and the Democrats' budget would spend about $1.5 trillion next fiscal year, with both budgets ending up with a deficit of about $330 billion. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Ethnic Serbian leaders in the Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia called today for the Federal Army to take control of their republic in order to prevent more ethnic violence. The Serbs oppose independence for Bosnia-Herzegovina because they fear that they'd be persecuted by the majority Muslim population and its allies, who are ethnic Croats. Muslims and Croats voted overwhelmingly for independence in a referendum last weekend. A federal judge has refused to allow Iran-Contra defendant Claire George to have access to millions of top-secret government documents. George, a former top-ranking CIA official, had been indicted on 10 felony counts of obstruction and lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Forcing access to classified information has been a legal tool used effectively by other Iran-Contra defendants. The special prosecutor had to drop the heart of the charges against former White House aide Oliver North because the administration would not declassify certain documents. And the case against former CIA station chief Joseph Fernandez was dropped for similar reasons. 3 months ago, defendant Claire George won access to some 750,000 classified documents that were released in connection with the North case and others. But George argued that he needed much more to put his role at the CIA in context. Federal Judge Royce Lamberth disagreed. George's request, he said, is, quote, an attempt to turn an Iran-Contra case into a three-ring circus involving all of the CIA's covert activities around the world. To grant this request, said the judge, would, quote, grind this case to a halt, and that he refused to do. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 27 points to close at 3,241.5. This is NPR News. The nation's major retailers reported today that sales were up in February, gaining for the second month in a row. Store owners cautioned that January and February are the slowest months of the year, and that this year's figures are compared with an even slower period last year at the start of the Persian Gulf War. Democratic presidential candidate Paul Tsongas telephoned Bob Kerry today during a campaign stop in Dallas after learning that the Nebraska senator had pulled out of the race. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Tsongas told reporters today Kerry had run a responsible campaign, and he looked forward to working with him in the future. At a campaign stop in Dallas, Texas, Tsongas said Kerry had a lot to be proud of, and longingly said there must be some relief in being able to finally relax. Tsongas said he had always felt a brotherhood with Kerry, comparing Kerry's Vietnam experience with his own cancer survival. Last March, Tsongas had paid a visit to Kerry in Washington, and he said if Kerry had known then that he was going to enter the race, Tsongas would not have run. Kostangas credited Kerry with bringing the issue of national health care to the forefront of the campaign. The fact is, he said, Bob Kerry has put national health insurance on the agenda forever. And when a national health care plan is passed, he'll be there to sign it. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Dallas.
The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said today that it will not accept a proposed $1.3 billion offer to settle civil suits against securities criminal Michael Milken. Milken is now serving a 10-year prison sentence in California. Once a top executive of Drexel Burnham Lambert, Milken is the man credited with pioneering the use of so-called junk bonds to finance corporate takeovers. In a letter to the district court in New York, the FDIC said it voted to reject the settlement because it didn't offer enough information to make an informed judgment. Lawyers for Drexel had told the court that the settlement, plus other payments, would leave Milken with a personal fortune of about $125 million. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a few minutes, we'll hear the story of how George Bush secretly aided Saddam Hussein before the Gulf War. The story was recently broken in the Los Angeles Times by reporters Murray Wass and my guest Douglas Franz. We invited Franz to also talk about his new book, A Full-Service Bank, the story of BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce. It was also known as the Bank of Crooks and Criminals because some of its best customers were drug dealers and terrorists. This is the first book about the BCCI scandal, but it's not a quickie. It was in the works long before the bank was closed down last summer. The book covers the history of BCCI and how it was started by a Pakistani banker who dreamed of creating the first Muslim-owned banking giant, a bank that could help third-world countries. The book also details the Customs Department sting operation, Operation Sea Chase, that led to the first indictments against BCCI officials. I asked Douglas Franz to give a short history of the bank.
Well, Agha Hassan Abadi, who was a Pakistani banker, founded the bank in 1972. At that time, Pakistan was preparing to nationalize its banks, and Abadi had founded a bank in Pakistan called the United Bank of Pakistan, and he could see that it was going to be nationalized, and so he set about creating his own bank, and he had assistance from the Bank of America, which provided him both with the initial prestige and some money, and more importantly, he had the assistance of some Arab sheikhs, particularly Sheikh Zayed of Abu Dhabi, who had been customers of his at United Bank. And so he saw the handwriting on the wall. He saw that Bhutto, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, was going to nationalize banks. So he started up BCCI. He began it in Luxembourg, soon moved to London, later moved to the Cayman Islands. And it's our belief that from the outset, he intended to create a bank that was without borders, a bank that was offshore everywhere, so that he could avoid any kind of a nationalization problem. He'd been stung once with a bank he created. He didn't want to be stung again. I think that was his mindset at the outset.
So how did the BCCI change from a bank that saw itself as Muslim-oriented to help Muslim countries? How did it change from that to start functioning as a money launderer and working with terrorists?
Well, I think it became a natural progression of a bank that operated outside of the control and regulation of any single regulator. Basically, it was a bank without rules. And when you don't have any rules, that means you can do basically anything you want to do. So we see from the late 70s until the early 80s, the bank was growing like mad, and they were taking in deposits without asking any questions. It was in 1981 that they became the banker to Abu Nidal, probably the world's most violent and feared terrorist. And that was, you know, partly they wanted his money, partly they were also trying to prove their bona fides to their Islamic bankers, to the Arab sheikhs who backed them, because at that time Abu Nidal was working out of Iraq, and Iraq had just started the Iran-Iraq war, and so this was a way for BCCI, according to what Kasem told me, this was a way for BCCI to show that it was a strong Arab bank by supporting Abu Nidal and indirectly Iraq. Some of Abu Nidal's arms shipments certainly went to Iraq. You know, so that's how that started. And then there came a period in the mid-1980s when the bank was growing fast and it was trading in the commodities market. They had a small operation based in London that was trading heavily in the commodities operation. And by heavily, I mean they were basically wagering $1 million to $10 million on a single stock transaction, and they lost a huge amount of money. And they had to find a way to recoup that money that they'd lost. And so, therefore, they began to solicit more and more funds from the drug runners of the world, from Manuel Noriega, and from all sorts of operations like that.
What do you think were some of the BCCI's most innovative contributions to corruption?
That's a great question. I think that the single most innovative contribution was BCCI's ability to move dirty money all across the globe. By having these operations in 73 countries, you could go in to a BCCI office, say in Panama, as the Medellin cartel often did, regularly did. You could go into the BCCI office in Panama City, downtown there, and turn over $1 million, $10 million, $100 million in cash, and you could have it wired into a bank account any place in the country. Because once it gets into that international wire system, you can't tell the dirty money from the clean money. It's like dropping a drop of ketchup into 100 gallons of milk. You know, for an instant you can see it, but then it just disappears. And so basically it was a huge international laundering operation. And they did that for the people in Medellin cartel. They did it for Manuel Noriega. I suspect they did that for the Central Intelligence Agency. We certainly know that the CIA used BCCI to pay operatives around the world. And that's, you know, another form of laundering money. Whether that was, I don't think that was necessarily illegal. But that was one of BCCI's major contributions, I think.
Can I ask you for one of the more entertaining stories that you learned during your investigation of the BCCI? I mean, it's the kind of story that is perversely entertaining.
It's very entertaining, and I hope that the entertainment value isn't lost in the book. One of the things we tried to do was keep people entertained. Some of the stories, the best stories I think come out of the undercover operation. Bob Mazur, the customs undercover guy who spent about 2 years undercover operating to try and get first Colombia money launderers and ultimately the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, you know, he had some of those really close calls that all undercover operatives on television experience, but here it was right from the outset he faced that problem. Initially, the undercover operatives had set up an apartment in Tampa that they were going to use to monitor meetings with the Medellin cartel and later with bank officials as well. And they were setting up recording equipment there on the very night they had the first meeting with their first money launderer. And the money launderer insisted on going with another undercover operative to that apartment. And so as they were coming there, Mazur was still inside the apartment changing around some of the recording equipment, and he heard a key in the door. And so he dove into the closet, and he had to sit there and for hours while these two men had their conversation. And then the Colombian decided he wanted to sleep overnight in the apartment, and so he went to sleep about 2 a.m. in the bed, and Mazur waited until he could hear the regular sound of his breathing and then had to crawl across the end of the bed out of the closet and slip out a second-story window.
The CIA had a report on the BCCI in 1986. They never even informed the Federal Reserve Bank, which regulates foreign banks seeking to operate here. Do you have any information about why the CIA basically sat on this?
Well, I don't have any hard conclusions about why. There's plenty of speculation about why. And I think the primary reason is that the CIA was using BCCI itself, not for illicit means, but to pay its operatives around the world. Here was a bank that was operating in every nasty corner of the globe, and that was perfect for the CIA to be able to pay off the people who were working for it. And so I think it was, in a sense, in the CIA's interest to keep this bank operating. And beyond that, I'm not sure why. We haven't seen evidence of corruption within the CIA. This was part of the bungling that the federal government did in the whole BCCI matter. I mean, it wasn't only the CIA that didn't tell the Federal Reserve what this bank was up to, the fact that it owned secretly First American Bank here in Washington, the biggest bank in the city. But, you know, it was the Federal Reserve failing to follow up on leads generated by Operation Sea Chase and the customs agents. It was the Justice Department failing to follow up on leads developed by the customs undercover operation. You know, we had that initial round of indictments in October 1988, and then this case sat dormant for 2 years. Nothing was done, and a lot of harm was done by BCCI to depositors around the world during that time period. I mean, the one thing we try not to lose sight of in this book is this is a wonderful scandal. It's filled with intrigue and deception and greed, but it's also a scandal that has real victims, and those real victims are poor people, hardworking Pakistani people all around the world who were sought out and catered to by BCCI. You know, the loss is going to range up to $15 billion, and that's hard-earned money that these people deposited at BCCI in good faith and wound up losing when this illicit bank crashed.
One of the big questions surrounding how long it took for the story of BCCI to really publicly emerge is whether federal agencies bungled it or covered the story up. Which do you think?
Well, I think our book presents a strong case for bungling, for miscommunication, for turf battles, for a failure to perceive how large this scandal was and pursue it aggressively. I mean, there have been stories put out there in the press, and, you know, certainly well-meaning stories, but I think they're stories that are only partially true or else not true at all, that there was some giant conspiracy within the Justice Department, within the federal government here, to keep a lid on BCCI. I think, unfortunately, the truth is that the federal government just didn't know how to cope with a scandal this big. They didn't understand what had been uncovered down there in Tampa, Florida, by this undercover operation, and therefore they just turned their backs on it. The Federal Reserve is very ill-equipped to deal with evidence developed in a criminal probe. There was a point after the indictments came down where an IRS agent who was assigned to the Customs Task Force that did the BCCI case came up and met with a Federal Reserve official who had jurisdiction over First American Bank, and he said, BCCI owns First American Bank. I can give you 6 or 8 witnesses who will tell you that. And this Federal Reserve official said, I need more than witnesses. I need documents. And, you know, in a sense, it was a bureaucrat's response. I think that's part of the bungling of this case by the Federal Reserve. Similar things happened at the Justice Department. There was a failure to take it seriously. Now, the Justice Department changed its horses once Dick Thornburgh left and William Barr came in. They got very aggressive. They brought a major racketeering indictment against the bank itself. They won a $550 million settlement just a couple of months ago that was approved. So, you know, but it was awfully late in the game for that.
Yesterday, we had on the head of the Center for Public Integrity, and this group just issued a study on the presidential campaign advisors, the advisors to the presidential candidates. And this study showed that one of George Bush's campaign advisors is James Lake, who has also been a public relations advisor to the Abu Dhabi Investment Corporation, which is the company that had the largest ownership of BCCI. Now, Lake says he doesn't lobby for them. He just advises them on dealing with the American media. Do you think that that's a significant conflict of interest?
I do think it's a conflict of interest because conflict of interest is not only actions, but it's appearance. And there's certainly the appearance of a conflict of interest here for James Lake. And I would have thought, frankly, that somebody as smart as Jim Lake would have stayed as far away as possible from BCCI. One of the sources in our book is a political consultant for another party, for the Democratic Party here in Washington. He's a very high-ranking guy. And he said he was approached by BCCI soon after the 1988 indictments. And they approached him and said, you know, we'd like for you to represent us and do a little lobbying on our behalf and just, you know, help us on public relations. And he said, I'll be happy to, but the first thing you have to do is conduct an internal investigation. I want to know how bad this scandal is. And BCCI said, well, we're not willing to do that. So he turned his back on a lot of money and walked away. And he's certainly thanking himself every single day now. But, you know, when Lake came in, the bad news was already out there on the table. I don't understand why he let himself get involved.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Franz. He's a Washington-based correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, co-author of the new book, A Full Service Bank, which is about BCCI. We're going to take a short break and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Douglas Franz is my guest, and he's co-authored a new book on the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. Well, Doug Franz, I'm going to change the subject on you and talk about a story that you broke recently for the Los Angeles Times having to do with President Bush and Saddam Hussein. And what you found was that President Bush, during his years as president and as vice president, aided Saddam Hussein before the war. Can you summarize for us what he did for Saddam Hussein?
Sure. I think it needs to be divided into two parts. When he was vice president in the Reagan administration, there was a publicly acknowledged, if not stated, tilt in American policy towards Saddam Hussein. We viewed him as a buffer to the Iranian fundamentalism, and therefore we supported him with aid throughout his eight-year war with Iran, hoping that he would contain the Ayatollah's crazies. And during that time period, George Bush, we disclosed in this, and Murray Wass was my co-author on that story, Murray and I disclosed through classified documents that George Bush played a very active role in assuring that aid to Bush. At one point in 1984, which was the first time we found Bush's fingerprints, the Iraq wanted to build a $500 million oil pipeline across Iraq to Aqaba so that it could get its oil out of Iraq and not have to go through the Strait of Hormuz, where the Iranian shipping was threatening the oil tankers. And so George Bush went to the Export-Import Bank, which is a federal agency here in Washington, and asked the president to approve this $500 million in U.S. loan guarantees so that Iraq could build this pipeline. The Export-Import Bank had been resisting that because its own economists said that Iraq wasn't creditworthy. But after George Bush went in there, that policy was reversed. The $500 million was approved. 3 years later, in 1987, the Iraqis wanted $200 million more in guarantees from the Export-Import Bank. Those guarantees had been cut off because Iraq, as expected, had not been paying its debts on earlier guarantees. But George Bush went in, telephoned the president, the new president of the Export-Import Bank, and lobbied him successfully to get this additional $200 million approved. The second phase of this occurred after Bush became president. By that time, the Iran-Iraq war was over. Iran was flat on its back. And even if you support the tilt toward Iraq during the 1980s, that was a time when most experts told Murray Wass and I that U.S. policy toward Saddam Hussein should be reevaluated. There should be a repositioning. We didn't want to make Saddam the biggest bully on the block in the Middle East. And we certainly saw ample evidence that he was becoming that. He was intent on becoming the biggest regional power in the Persian Gulf. And rather, however, than reassess our aid, we increased it and increased it. And there was, despite numerous evidences of scandal, despite intelligence reports that showed that this economic aid was being diverted for military purposes by Iraq, and despite a big brewing bank scandal here involving an Italian bank in Atlanta, the administration insisted on approving more aid for Iraq. And George Bush played an important role in that because in October 1989, he issued a national security directive ordering American U.S. agencies to increase political and economic ties with Iraq.
So you think that George Bush helped Saddam Hussein build his war machine?
Without question, U.S. aid backed and pushed by George Bush for at least 8 years was vital to Saddam's building his war machine. And it was not necessarily, Terry, that we gave him military goods, although in fact we did license $1.5 billion worth of sensitive U.S. technology to be sold to Iraq. But the important thing is here that we gave Saddam Hussein more than $5 billion in loan guarantees for food aid primarily, but that what that did was free up Saddam's hard currency so that he could spend it on the world's arms markets and build his nuclear capabilities, his biological weapons capabilities, and his chemical weapons capabilities. I mean, I don't think that there's any escaping the link between $5 billion worth of U.S. aid and the war machine that just a year ago, last week, we crushed in the Persian Gulf.
Do you think that anything in this story that you broke helps explain the personalization of the war, the way George Bush helped make this a war about George Bush versus Saddam Hussein?
Yes, that's a good question, and I think it does. And it personalizes it in a sense from Saddam Hussein's point of view, because Saddam Hussein had seen for years that George Bush was his friend. I mean, what the policy that Saddam Hussein had seen coming from George Bush personally was one of assistance, and some people have called it appeasement. So, you know, Saddam Hussein, in a sense, viewed this as personal help, and I think he was probably not crazy when he expected that the United States would not do anything when he marched into Kuwait.
What's the other significance of the information that you've uncovered?
Well, I think the other significance, Terry, is that the administration appears to have misled Congress, particularly over the motivation for this $5 billion in agricultural loan guarantees that we provided to Iraq. This is best illustrated, I think, by what happened to Senator Patrick Leahy, the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee. In February of 1990, Leahy heard rumors that the $1 billion that had been approved by the Agriculture Department for food aid to Iraq had been approved only after pressure was applied for foreign policy reasons. Clayton Yeider, who is now the president's domestic policy advisor at the time, was agriculture secretary, and Leahy wrote Yeider and asked him, are these rumors true? Yeider wrote back and said, oh, to the contrary, there's no foreign policy pressure involved. Well, in fact, what our stories showed, I think, in incontrovertible evidence based on classified documents as specific as talking points in James Baker's handwriting, was that the State Department and the White House National Security Council had, in fact, pressured the Agriculture Department to approve that $1 billion and hundreds of millions of dollars prior to that. You know, it was as specific as James Baker on October 31st, 1989, calling up Clayton Yeider and asking him to approve the full $1 billion, which had been opposed by the Agriculture Department. And Yeider, in Baker's own handwriting on this classified document, Baker said, Yeider responded, I think we see it your way, I'll get involved. Soon after that, the full $1 billion was ultimately approved.
What reverberations has the story had?
Well, it's interesting. They've been both what we expected and less than we expected. They've been what we expected in the sense that the congressmen, particularly, who feel they were lied to, read this and have been outraged. Congressman Henry Gonzalez from Texas, the chairman of the House Banking Committee, has entered two large reports in the Congressional Record and Plans hearings on this subject. Patrick Leahy also plans to do an investigation through the Agricultural Committee. There's been some outrage in Congress. What's interesting, though, Terry, is that the rest of the nation's press hasn't followed up on this at all. It's very easy for the press to follow up after the Star gives us the Jennifer Flowers, Bill Clinton story. But they're not willing, it seems to me, to go the extra step and try and follow up on a substantive series of stories that go to questions of Reagan and Bush administration judgment on key foreign policy issues, particularly when they're so directly related to the events that led us to the Persian Gulf War.
Okay. Douglas Franz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And Douglas Franz is a Washington-based reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's also co-author of the new book, A Full Service Bank. It's about the BCCI, and it's just been published by Pocket Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Cuban Revolution split up many families, including the family of Cristina Garcia. When she was two, her family fled to New York, but her grandmother and many aunts and uncles chose to stay and work for the revolution. Her divided family was the inspiration for her new novel, Dreaming in Cuban, about three generations of Cuban women, each with a different vision of her native country. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Tuskegee Experiments, the debut album by clarinetist Don Byron. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Senator Bob Kerry has taken himself out of the race for the Democratic presidential nomination, leaving four major candidates still in the contest. Saying that his campaign ran out of gas, Kerry conceded that money problems were a major concern. His campaign is said to be about $1 million in debt. Kerry did not endorse any of those still in the Democratic race, but said that he could support any of them. He blamed himself for his failed campaign and said most of his bad breaks were self-inflicted. He said he did not hit his stride with his message until the closing days of the New Hampshire primary, and that was too late. On Capitol Hill, the House Ethics Committee has recommended that the names of 24 current and former members of the House be made public as punishment for their writing of bad checks. The panel says that they were the worst abusers of the House bank. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The House Ethics Committee found that some 355 members of Congress wrote just under 20,000 bad checks. Many Republicans say naming just 24 of the worst abusers, therefore, is tantamount to a whitewash. Members recognize that, as one put it, the reputation of the House is at stake. And Republican Jim Bunning of Kentucky, a member of the Ethics Committee, says more abusers should be identified.
I don't think the American people will look at this resolution. I don't think they think that we'll pass the smell test.
Even though no taxpayer money was lost through the House members' bad checks, the scandal makes the entire Congress look bad in an election year when incumbents are already threatened like never before. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Washington has agreed to give Vietnam more humanitarian aid, some $3 million more, in exchange for greater cooperation in the search for Americans missing in the Vietnam War. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The increased aid was announced during a visit to Hanoi by U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Richard Solomon, who said, according to Reuters, that Vietnam had proposed new ways to help resolve POW/MIA cases. Also, Solomon reportedly said Vietnam appears to be supporting a UN peace plan for neighboring Cambodia. Both steps are required under Washington's so-called roadmap for normalizing U.S. relations with Vietnam, a plan that could fully restore ties between the two countries in 1993. Vietnam's Deputy Foreign Minister, Le Mai, expressed appreciation for the increased U.S. aid, but also said the response from the U.S. government remains very modest. Other governments are rapidly boosting their assistance to Vietnam. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 27 points to close at 3,241.50. On volume of some 206 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. Attorneys in Ireland say a ruling by that nation's Supreme Court allowing a 14-year-old to have an abortion in Britain has expanded the nation's limited right to abortion. The court last month voted 4-1 to overturn an order barring the teenager from leaving the country. The ruling was read by the High Court this morning. The teenager has said that she was raped by the father of a friend. The High Court said their ruling centered more on the girl's threats to kill herself than the right to travel. The German government has renewed pressure on Russia for the extradition of former East German leader Erich Honecker. After Russian doctors gave the 79-year-old Honecker a clean bill of health earlier this week, he returned to Chile's embassy in Moscow. Deidre Berger reports.
According to diplomatic sources in Moscow, the German ambassador to Russia visited top-level Russian officials today to press Bonn's extradition demands. Since Erich Honecker fled to the Chilean embassy in Moscow last year, there's been a permanent tug of war among Germany, Russia, and Chile over Honecker's fate. The Russian government claims the matter must be decided between Germany and Chile. But Bonn officials have been encouraged by recent statements from Russian officials that Moscow is working on a mechanism to enable Honecker to be extradited to Germany. Further statements from Russian officials the past few days about Honecker have raised hopes in Bonn he will soon be brought to Germany to face trial. The Chilean government is still undecided about offering residence to Honecker. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Yugoslavia diplomat Cyrus Vance has called on all sides in Bosnia to avoid violence, but said that he is encouraged that Muslim, Serbian, and Croatian leaders have agreed to attend peace talks sponsored this weekend by the European Community. Vance also said that the situation continues to be tense. A Serbian leader has warned that the current situation could lead to civil war. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Many middle-class families fled Cuba after the revolution. Cristina Garcia and her parents left for New York when she was two. But they left behind Cristina's grandmother and many aunts and uncles who chose to stay and work for the revolution. Garcia's first novel, Dreaming in Cuban, is about three generations of women in a family like her own that was divided by the revolution. Each of the women has a different vision of her native country and the revolution. Garcia is a former Time magazine reporter. For a while, she was based in Miami. It was the first time she was around a Cuban community. We invited Garcia to talk with us and read from her novel. In this passage, we meet the youngest main character, Pilar, who moved to New York as a child and desperately wants to return to Cuba and see her grandmother again.
I was only 2 years old when I left Cuba, but I remember everything that's happened to me since I was a baby, even word-for-word conversations. I was sitting in my grandmother's lap, playing with her drop pearl earrings, when my mother told her we were leaving the country. My grandmother called her a traitor to the revolution. Mom tried to pull me away, but I clung to my grandmother and screamed at the top of my lungs. My grandfather came running and said, "Celia, let the girl go. She belongs with her mother." That was the last time I saw her. My mother says that my grandmother had plenty of chances to leave Cuba, but that she's stubborn and got her head turned around by a leader. Mom says communist, the way some people say cancer, low and fierce. She reads the newspapers page by page for leftist conspiracies, jams her finger against imagined evidence and says, "See, what did I tell you?" Last year, when a leader jailed a famous Cuban poet, she sneered at those leftist intellectual hypocrites for trying to free him. "They created those prisons, so now they should rot in them," she shouted, not making much sense at all. "They're dangerous subversives, red to the bone." Mom's views are strictly black and white. It's how she survives.
Cristina Garcia, was your family divided by the Cuban Revolution?
Oh, absolutely. They were split right down the middle. All of my father's family chose to come to the United States, and all of my mother's family decided to stay for because they were politically committed to the changes.
So did that disrupt the family?
Oh, yes. There was a very bitter political schism in my family for many years, and it's the wounds have been very slow in healing, actually. It hasn't been until recent years that my mother has made amends with her family.
What was that process like?
I think it was a very, very emotional and draining experience on both sides. I think they had been so intransigent and so entrenched in their own positions for so long that it was very difficult to shed them, at least at a distance. I think the minute, though, they reunited in Cuba, when my mother first went back to Cuba in the early 80s, all of that resistance melted away at first sight. And I think they realized on both sides what they had been missing all these years.
Do you think that it's typical of Cuban families that they were divided by the revolution?
Oh, I think almost every Cuban family has a story to tell along those lines. I don't think there's a single Cuban family that was not affected in one way or another by the revolution, or split, or. Had grave tensions as a result of what happened politically in Cuba.
Was there a particular incident that led you to want to write this novel about a family that's separated by the revolution?
Well, I think what happened was my sister and I took a trip to Cuba in 1984, and I had not been back since I'd left in 1961 at 2.5 years old. And it was a very exhilarating experience for me to meet all of my family there. And I think the experience just marinated in the back of my brain for many years. And then when I finally sat down in 1989 to write the book, it all coalesced.
How did the Cuba of reality in 1984 compare to what you had imagined all the years you were living in the United States?
Well, as you can imagine, I, as well as many Cubans of my generation, have grown up with very skewed ideas about Cuba, especially since our homes were generally vehemently anti-Castro. And so to me, to actually go visit Cuba personally, it was really a far cry from the monstrous situation painted by my parents and others of their generation. But, you know, then again, I personally did not suffer what they suffered or lose what they lost. And so to me, it certainly did not seem, so bad. And I think that was also reinforced by the fact that all of my mother's family there, or many of them, even though they were struggling, were very committed to the revolution, and even if given the opportunity, would not necessarily leave. This is not everybody, but certainly my grandmother there, and other cousins and aunts and uncles.
Why did your parents leave Cuba?
Oh, just like so many other Cubans, they had lost property, and they were just. They left initially thinking they were going to be back in 6 months or a year. I don't think anybody ever anticipated that this would turn into a permanent exile.
They thought the revolution would end and then they'd return.
Exactly, and so many people were living catch as catch can for quite some time in hotels or taking temporary jobs, and it took a while to face the fact that the situation in Cuba would not turn around immediately or even in the near future, and so they settled down to start getting on with their lives.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Cristina Garcia. She's written a new novel called Dreaming in Cuban. She's a former Time magazine reporter. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Cristina Garcia is my guest. She was born in Havana, grew up in the States, and has written a new novel called Dreaming in Cuban about a family that was separated by the Cuban Revolution, divided by the Cuban Revolution. So how close did you get with your relatives who had stayed in Cuba when you visited?
Well, it was an immediate, there was an immediate warmth and attraction, and it was as if 20 plus years had not evaporated since the last time we had seen each other. There was no sense of formality, no introductions, nothing. I mean, it was just a hearty embrace and literally and figuratively for the entire 2 weeks I was there. And I spent much of the time just talking to my grandmother, who, it was so funny, it was like landing in a place and the tribe sort of looks like you and talks like you and has your mannerisms. It was just wonderful. It was a very magical experience.
Were there specific stories that you heard told from a different perspective when you were with your family who stayed in Cuba? Stories that you had heard your parents tell, but you had a very different version now from the family who'd stayed behind.
Well, I had always wondered, you know, given the way Cuba had been painted to me as I was growing up, why any of my relatives would have wanted to stay there. And the explanation was always, well, they just forget how it was before the revolution. You know, they don't remember you could have hot water and soap every day and, you know, for their baths. And when I got to Cuba, that wasn't the case at all. My grandmother and my relatives remembered very well what things were like before the revolution, and yet they were still willing to make the sacrifices. They felt, I think at one point in the book, I talk about Celia, the matriarch of this clan, talking that she felt that she was part of a great historical unfolding. And that was very much the sense I got from several of my relatives there. Now, not all of them. There were several who were anxious to leave and for various reasons. But there were a couple of real diehards, and they continued to be diehards and, you know, very committed to the revolution. And that hasn't changed.
The grandmother in your novel was on was a judge on the People's Court. I mean, not mm-hmm. the TV show People's Court, but a neighborhood People's Tribunal. Right. And I wonder if your grandmother was in that kind of position.
Yes, she was, as a matter of fact. And she was involved in the revolution on many different levels. She was part of the neighborhood committee at one point, and she actually did quite a bit of acting in local theater troupes. And I think she was just a kind of eminence grise of the neighborhood. I mean, a lot of people always came by her house, asked her for advice. She was very well respected in her neighborhood. And she was very revolutionary. It was very funny because I have cousins my age there, and they had boyfriends. They were dating. And the main criterion for my grandmother in determining the worth of these suitors was, were they revolutionary? Were they serious boys? And I thought that was very interesting.
When you returned to Cuba, did Cubans there spot you for someone who had grown up in America?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Just the way I was dressed and my accent gave me away immediately. Yeah, they would call me gringa down there.
How'd you react to that?
Oh, I just laughed. I mean, it was true. I couldn't avoid it. Opened my mouth and it was all over.
What was the food like, and how did it compare to the kind of food your mother cooked?
Well, they suffer from quite a few shortages down there, and you know, all the food is rationed. So what ended up happening was I would take my relatives, that my sister and I would treat my relatives to meals at the tourist hotels, and where there were huge buffets and plenty of seafood and vegetables, and my family would go wild. I mean, they hadn't seen some of this stuff in years, and it was quite poignant, actually. I mean, I had one aunt just stuffing everything she could into her purse and her pockets and eating till she burst every night. It's tough there. And, you know, the few meals that we did have at their home were very basic and very starch-laden. They get a lot of, you know, huge allowance for lard, rice, and sugar. Mm. I think 5 pounds a month for sugar, and they use it. no shortage of that in Cuba.
Cristina Garcia, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you. It was really a pleasure.
Cristina Garcia's novel, Dreaming in Cuban, is published by Knopf. Until 1988, it was illegal to import music from Cuba into the United States. This was a provision of the Trading with the Enemy law. When those restrictions were loosened, David Byrne co-produced a collection of Cuban music from the 60s and 70s titled Dancing with the Enemy. From that collection, here's a 1978 hit from Cuban singer Celeste Mendoza.
Diana, 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 Diana. Diana, 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 Diana. Diana, 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 Diana.
no sepa bailar mi rumba buena. Escucha bien este quinto y también el tumbador. Y si no sabe bailar, no ten cuidado que te quema. ¡Ay, qué pena!
¡Ay, qué pena!
Que tú no sepas bailar.
Celeste Mendoza from the album Dancing with the Enemy. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tonight, a professor in Vancouver tells us that lemmings don't commit suicide. He says no animals commit suicide. Lemmings are, however, vicious killers of baby lemmings. The computer virus Michelangelo is set to go off tomorrow. We'll talk with the computer expert Cliff Stoll about the craft of devising viruses and ways to track them down. Robert Siegel brings us information about Azerbaijan as our series on the former Soviet republics continues. Also, we'll check on the political situation in American Samoa and letters from listeners, especially about Puerto Rico and about AIDS.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Don Byron is a clarinetist who does a little bit of everything, from classical music to jazz to downtown rock to klezmer music. Playing klezmer music, which has its roots in the Jewish culture of Eastern Europe, has attracted the most attention to Byron, partly because Byron is black, dreadlocked, and comes from the Bronx. His first album as a leader is just out. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
John Byron didn't put any klezmer music on his debut album, reasoning that if he did, it'd distract folks from everything else he does. Still, his album Tuskegee Experiments has a lot of different stuff on it, from Byron's own compositions to a piece each by Duke Ellington and 19th century composer Robert Schumann. Byron can play that music, but I like his piping jazz clarinet better. Even when his improvised lines aren't so melodically interesting, they have the kind of rhythmic urgency swing-era clarinetists got. In fact, Byron's a big fan of Artie Shaw and Ellington clarinetist Jimmy Hamilton, who have that same thing happening. Sometimes, Byron phrases almost like a drummer. It's significant that last year, he was on three really good albums by drummers, Bobby Previtt, Jerry Hemingway, and Ralph Peterson, who also plays on Byron's record. Peterson is one of the loudest drummers in jazz and displays the same sort of raw energy Byron does. This is from Duke Ellington's Main Stem. That's Bill Frisell on guitar and Lonnie Plaxico on bass. They're on about half of Don Byron's album. I've seen Byron play a lot in the last 3 years, and I've heard people in the audience make some wacko comments about him. Some folks say he must think he's Jewish because he plays klezmer, as if that clarinet-dominated music couldn't appeal to him on its own merits. Anyway, to make it clear Byron knows his real roots, his piece Tuskegee Experiment deals with a harrowing episode in African-American history. At the Tuskegee Institute in the 1930s, black men diagnosed as having syphilis were neither told of their condition nor treated for it, so doctors could study the disease's effects. The poet narrator is Sadiq.
Bring them to autopsy with ulcerated limbs, with howling wives. Bring them in one coon corpse at a time, says Dr. Dibble. $1 a year for 40 years to watch these shadows rot. They didn't receive treatment for syphilis, but they got so much else. Medicine is as much art as it is science.
Records that try to do a little of this and a little of that don't always add up to much, but Don Byron avoids that pitfall with his new album. You don't hear much from young jazz clarinet players, not because they don't exist, but because record companies aren't very interested in them. Well, if there's room for only one new clarinetist in record store racks, we could do worse than Byron. An album under his name has been long overdue, but Tuskegee Experiments was worth the wait.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shura and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet actor Stephen Lang. He starred in the film adaptation of Last Exit to Brooklyn and is about to play Hamlet on Broadway. He's also co-starring in a made-for-TV movie based on the story of the rape of Nancy Ziegenmeier. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.